Welcome to The Middle Ground, an audio series highlighting literature and exploring literary communities across Central and Eastern Europe.
In this episode, host Andrew Singer speaks remotely with Rimas Uskiris about his translation of the short story By Remote Means by Lithuanian author Danutė Kalinauskaitė. Then we enjoy this entire story read by Kristen Miller. Andrew began by asking Rimas how he came to translate this particular work and about the translation process.
Danutė Kalinauskaitė had become pretty well known in the last few years. She won the National Prize for Arts and Literature in 2017, which is one of the biggest awards anyone in the arts can get here. And I had previously it had been recommended to me to read her latest book, Skersvėjų Namai, which is translated as Home of Drafts or something along those lines. Draft is not such a good word, but it is the correct translation for Skersvėjas. Skersvėjas has this wonderful feeling of a wind that's cutting through you, or a crosswind, really. But it's a much more poetic title in my mind in Lithuanian. And so I had been reading her short stories from that book, and been talking to some friends in the literary scene here about top short story writers, and that I need something for Trafika. And they recommended that I try something new by Danutė. So I talked to her and by remote means, actually. We messaged each other, and she thought that this would be a good story, which was a newer story published in 2017. So that's how I came to it. And her work is challenging. It has quite a linguistic variety to it. It can be very high literary poetic language, and at the same time it can quickly shift to slang, informal speech, and curse words, sometimes in multiple languages. So she will freely throw in Russian words or Polish words, probably more Russian than anything else. And those shifts in register are challenging, and some of her sentence structures also have this rather typical Lithuanian Baroque quality of long, winding sentences where for us it can be hard to figure out what's the subject, where's the object of the verb, where is the verb, and so on. And often they're run-on sentences. The run-on sentence is much more acceptable in Lithuanian than it is in English, even in literature. And so it can be a real challenge how to sort of muscle these Baroque, long, winding sentences into something that is readable in English, that doesn't sound like translationese, while, of course, at the same time, you don't want to turn it into Hemingway or something, right? You want to keep an element of her style, as foreign as it is to us, while at the same time not sounding like some kind of amateur translator who's just doing a translationese assignment for class.
So it sounds like there's two different interconnected main issues. One is Lithuanian style and Lithuanian language itself encourages this, as you say, long Baroque style. And the second issue is that this writer has really absorbed the advances of modernism in fiction and is using a lot of these techniques to stylize the narrative. In terms of the first one, have you over time evolved a particular voice in your head for dealing with long Baroque Lithuanian style sentences? Or is it case by case, you just start from scratch and feel it out?
I think it's probably, for me, more case by case, since most of my work is in poetry. And although you certainly get complex syntax in poetry, it is still broken up into lines. And so many people like to say, oh, poetry, it's so hard, it's much harder than prose. And I don't think they've ever tried translating some of the Lithuanian fiction writers that we have, because I think actually they're much harder to translate. The fact that poetry is broken into lines still gives some discreteness to the units you deal with. Of course, you don't just go line by line in poems, but you often can, actually, surprisingly. And you don't have to switch around lines as often as you might think. But in these long prose sentences, you really do have to switch things around. You have to find the right analytic order, right? We have an analytic language in English, and they have a synthetic language in Lithuanian. And we do really have to switch things around. And when it's a long sentence, it's really can be a brain puzzle, a brain burner, really, how to make it work.
For our listeners who may not know what that is, can you explain what a synthetic language is?
I'm not a linguistic expert, of course, but the simple fact is they use declensions for their nouns. And that means that the word order of sentences can, not just their nouns, I'm sorry, but adjectives and adverbs too. And so the order of the sentences, the order of words in a sentence is highly variable. It does not go as clearly subject, verb, object as it does in English or French, for instance. And you can find the verb in all kinds of funny places, and you have to figure out which adjectives and adverbs go where. Based on the endings of the words, the declensions of the words tell you what grammatical case they're in. And so because there isn't that same analytical logic order that we have, you really have to be good with your grammar sometimes to figure out what's going with what and how to switch it around to make it English. So that's, I guess, the short answer.
I don't mean to put you on the spot here necessarily, but might you have an example to hand from this story where you could read us a little bit of the original and then talk about some of this kind of translation issues in context?
Yes, I believe I could. I've picked out some examples that maybe aren't the long Baroque sentences, but perhaps one of them has some of that to it. That's such a common problem with Lithuanian that I was in this particular story also stuck with her vocabulary, which as I was saying, it's not only shifts from formal to informal, from poetic to slang, but uses foreign words, in fact uses very rare Lithuanian words sometimes.
One reason we were so happy to get this story for our Traffic of Europe issue is you've handled the vocabulary of it in such a delightful and rich way. So, I mean, the story is rife with sunchokes and hogweed and tansies and all of these exotic words, which makes it such a rich and wonderful text to read.
Yeah, well, some of those are easy. You know, you can just use Wikipedia, basically, to find what the plant actually is in English and at least get some options that way. Some of hers are a bit harder. So I'm going to read one example where, you know, I read it again. I think, well, maybe I could have done that differently. I'm glad you enjoyed the vocabulary, but reading it again, there's all these little places where you think, well, maybe that wasn't quite right. So one longer sentence that has some of that strange vocabulary in it, including shifts of tone, occurs more towards the end. And I'll read it first in English. Even the victim, due to a serious deterioration of health, without even taking part in the proceedings, collapsed at home, his palace, by bay leaf, lying on a Louis XIV sofa, the hand of the patron hanging from the armrest like a rag, 100,000 in the culo, and not a whiff of the thief. To whom, by the devil, is God responsible? Okay, so I think you can get a little bit of that, how convoluted that can sound. Mm-hmm. And it's not easy to parse it all out. Of course, this is out of context, and bay leaf is the name of a restaurant, which appears earlier. It was actually a real restaurant in Vilnius. It might still be here, for all I know. And lots of things are happening there. And one of the tricky parts was, towards the end, in Lithuanian, she says "šimtas tūkstančių." That's 100,000. That's I believe it was euros at this time. No, it might not have been euros at this time. Actually, when it takes place, it might have been litai still. 100,000, and then she says "kaip įrūra, o vagies nepadūju." And that's very tricky because "rūra" is not a Lithuanian word. In fact, it's a rarer. It's a Polish word, Polish slang for you know, excuse my language, but you know, ass or arse, as the British say, and it was one of those cases where it's not the Russian slang, which she uses a little more often, but a strange Polish word gets in here. And that's why in English I chose the word culo, because it's a word in English that we can use, and most people will know what that is. And it has that a foreign flair to it. And then after that, she says, "O vagies ne paduju," and I translated that and "not a whiff of the thief." And that "ne paduju" is also this strange expression that it's idiomatic in Lithuanian, for basically meaning, you know, there's not a trace left, right? And it occurs even in children's literature. I was reading a book to my kids, a kid's book, and it uses that expression, "ne paduju," several times. And my daughter's like, "What is that, Daddy? What is that?" And I'm trying to figure out how to exactly translate it to her. And so I chose "not a whiff" as a kind of idiomatic equivalent. And, you know, and then she goes back to this metaphysical element in that sentence, right? To whom by the devil is God responsible? And that's often what happens. Her stories shift between this sort of kind of everyday scene, often described in ornate detail. Then there's suddenly some slang thrown in, some informal speech. And then there's a bigger metaphysical perspective opened up, which is often a questioning one, questioning whether there's bigger forces at work here without necessarily answering, right? Hinting that there could be, but she often doesn't give you a definite answer.
And then you have the issue of what is the writer's tone to the narration and how does it shift within the sentence? Where does the level of irony or distancing or mocking or self-deprecation or sly dig, you know, I mean, there's so many shifts in register which correspond to shifts in emotional relation to the content that she's saying. And that must be terrifically hard to reproduce without the cultural context especially.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases it's clear enough. Like here, she has a colon after the hand of the patron is hanging from the armrest, and then it goes into the 100,000 in the culo. So there's clearly marked in a way where the shift in tone is happening. But there's other cases where I think there was one or two other cases. I don't remember exactly. It's been a few years where I didn't catch something. And I had a friend who's an expert translator, a native Lithuanian speaker, who knows English very well too, Marius Burokas, the poet. And he read through this whole piece, my whole translation, and he caught a few places where I hadn't picked up on the tone and the irony. So I was very grateful to that. And God knows we all as translators could use a very good editor like that to help us out in difficult texts like this.
Are you ever tempted to use footnotes in a work like this? Are you very strongly against that? I mean, it's a work of fiction. It would certainly change the feeling of it if it were footnoted. But some of this is awfully hard to explain otherwise.
That's a wonderful question, Andrew, and I would say yes, I am tempted. Often if I'm submitting to a journal or having it published in a journal, I'll try to do without footnotes, because my impression is a lot of editors don't really want them. If I was doing a book of her work, I would definitely have footnotes or a glossary. Because, see, what happens sometimes is I got rid of the foreign. Here I changed it to Spanish, and okay, maybe that worked in this one case because it's a word that in English we're going to know, right? But I wouldn't want to change everything into Spanish because then suddenly the characters start sounding like they're from Spain or Latin America, right? It gives the wrong feeling of the character. They're not that at all. So you can't do everything in a language that's closer to English. And of course, leaving it in Russian or Polish is also going to be very difficult for most English speakers because those are languages that are not close to us. And we tend to not know words from there. And so yes, you either have to find an English slang equivalent, in which case you lose that flavor of the foreign that she has, or you have to keep it and put a footnote in. And I am inclined, especially if it's ever comes out as a book, right? I'm inclined to do that as a matter of principle for the book, and to get the reader used to seeing footnotes, because I want that foreignness in there. It just gets very tricky how to do it in a way that's smooth and easily understandable.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly a consideration, because you also want to encourage someone to immerse in this frame of the fiction and not be distracted intellectually as they're moving through the story, as rich as it is. So it is a trade-off. It's, as you say, a glossary or endnotes might be the way to go. Can you give us another example and read first the original Lithuanian and then your translation and then discuss it?
Sure. This one's a short example. It's related to what we were just talking about with the different languages. So the sentence is relatively simple. Vyresnysis saujoje svarindamas pundelį nugurkė seilę. Ne veltui vargta, ką bešenyje dengi. Okay, so that last part is my poor pronunciation of Russian. In English, how it goes is the older one, weighing the wad in his hand, swallowed his spit. Not for nothing did we do this work, eh? Mad money here. So there we had the problem of, well, pundelis is kind of slang for a wad or a stack of something. And here it's slang for, you know, a stack of money. So I decided wad might work here. Nugurke seile is a really kind of literary way of saying swallowed his spit. And maybe there's a better word I could use for that. I didn't think of one, but it's a kind of unusual word, because the normal word would be nurio seile. And she uses a more rare word, nugurkit, a rare and unusual Lithuanian word. And then you have the shift with the speech, the quotation marks, not for nothing did we do this work, eh? And mad money here. Mad money here is my translation of the Russian. So again, we're losing something. My expression has the slangy quality of what in the kind of informal speech of how the character is speaking, but it loses the Russian aspect there. So, you know, again, there's a bunch of these foreign words, and so that brings us back to that issue of when should we decide to throw in the footnotes and when do we hold back and just try to find a slang equivalent in English. In this case, again, you know, most Lithuanians are going to understand that. That's not a complicated or rare Russian expression from what people tell me. I had to ask my friends to be sure, but nevertheless, right, it's tricky. It's tricky how she writes this.
This author in particular, she's very active as well with Lithuanian culture and heritage and folklore and these kinds of things. I think she works at the Institute of Lithuanian Literature and Folklore, if I'm not mistaken, or she has?
I believe she did. I'm not sure if she's still there now. The Institute for Literature and Folklore isn't necessarily a folkloric activity. It is a scholarly enterprise that is looking at Lithuanian heritage, especially literary heritage. So I wouldn't say that means she's especially involved in folklore. It does mean that she's a scholar of literature.
Anyway, in general, Lithuanian literary culture is filled to overflowing with folklore, fairy tales, folk tales, legends, and references like that. I mean, it's an incredibly rich culture. Do you, over time, develop a sense of an attitude of systematizing some of that lore into English? I mean, have you evolved in your relation to Lithuanian lore as you've progressed as a translator? How does that work for you?
Well, the thing is that a lot of contemporary writers have been moving away from that a little bit. It was a big issue in the Soviet era and in the early independence time, post-Soviet era, as a way of, you know, asserting Lithuanian identity and saying that, you know, we have our folklore too, and it can be used for high art, just like other people used it in the past, you know, and you know, going back to the modernists. in English and other European places, we're using folklore. You know, I'm thinking of music now, like Bartok and Stravinsky, for some reason. I'm thinking of music, but so Lithuanians were doing that. Now it's not so common now, except it is there in Kalinauskaitė. I mean, you're right about that, but it's there subtly. She doesn't actually have, you know, witches and monsters literally in her stories. But for instance, she has one story where this family, you know, is having some strife. They're on a trip and they in a country road meet some old woman. And there's all these hints that this woman, for instance, looks like this witch who had recently died, this famous pagan witch. And the old woman sort of acts in a strange way. And then there's this mysterious disappearance where she and the son vanish and then the son appears again. And it's never exactly saying this woman is a witch or that she's some kind of pagan spirit. But there's these hints like, well, maybe she is, right? And that's how Danuta Kalinauskaitė operates a lot in her stories, where there's these hints of the devil. Right? The devil is a very old folkloric creature in Lithuanian and Polish folklore and literature. And right, so there's this guy who may be a manifestation of the devil, but maybe not, right? Maybe it's just the character is imagining this. So she works more with these kind of hints and allusions that leave the story open, where you can read it in a realist way, or you can read it in this more mystical and metaphysical way. And that's actually one of the compelling aspects, right? Even in this story, there's an element that is possibly mystical, right? There's this remote means by which a robbery takes place, and that's tied into what's happening in the life of one of the characters. And it's never made exactly clear, is there mystical coincidences here? Are there mystical forces? Is one of the characters kind of a supernatural creature, or is this just a realist story with some strange coincidences? And I think Kalinauskaitė has this way of intimating these folkloric aspects without making them fully explicit, so that you're never quite sure on what level to read the story. And that's one of the intriguing things about them, is there's these different levels. And but she's not coming out and saying it is this way or that way.
Wonderful. It's always a pleasure to talk with you about these topics, and you're expressing this in such an articulate way. It's terrific.
Thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you. I know that also that you're so very busy right now these days with your teaching, your family, and now sadly with this renewed lockdown in Lithuania. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to do it. I look forward to talking with you again sometime.
This has been Rimas Uzgiris speaking with us about his translation of the short story By Remote Means by Lithuanian author Danutė Kalinauskaitė. And we're going to hear now the whole short story in English, read by Kristen Miller.
"Let her be happy that someone still visits," said the older one as they snuck up the steps. She lived on the second floor of an old wooden apartment building with a moaning staircase. She climbed down them backwards, holding onto the railing. The image of her walking backwards. It seems that a person moves forward, but in reality, it's all backwards. She moves towards her end because the front for such people has already come to its end. The two of them ran up, well, gambled more like it, quite like squirrels, holding carefully, one to the railing, one to the walls, so that the stairs wouldn't squeak. When they snuck into the kitchen, they found her in the depths of the room, in the dense clutter of things and patterns, with a hanging carpet in the background picturing deer, bent over by her bed, rummaging about. She had slept there alone for many years now. She covered her bed by day in a curtain of tulle and placed on top of it a doll with dusty curls. The older one knew where she kept her money, for, with an idea from the Spiritus Movens, the rogue had hidden in the canopy of a maple tree opposite the kitchen window, and worked out that if he waited until the postal worker left, the money was in a rectangular purse, something like an envelope, placed inside an aluminum kettle, which was itself secreted on a rafter. She reached it, he could clearly see this through a gap in the leaves, by climbing up a bit, with trembling hands, struggling. She only heard them when they came down from the rafter with a crash. "The wretches, one was brown, the other green," she managed to say in the kitchen, her hair in a braid like a radish tail, her eye twitching from a tick, to two militia officers who had come in. The neighbors were already gathering down below. Events like this, after all, break the daily routine. Even the most neighborly of neighbors, as is well known, likes the smell of our blood. The ensuing discussion that usually flares up and spreads to broader themes. Politicians are all swindlers and crooks, a state of liars, thieves, pedophiles. Everyone has something to say and flays the hides of those up high, among the clouds, next to God, where you can't reach them, choose them, or spit on them, though you want to. Hunched over, the two ran along fences through gardens, sunflowers, and sunchokes until they stopped to catch their breath in the wintercress jungle of a garden. Or maybe it was Sosnowski's hogweed, which back then no one feared. The brown one, the elder, breathlessly pulled out the loot. But in the crocheted, flowery percale purse, similar to an envelope, there was more than just money. And this threw them off their track a bit. It was the woman herself. Her 90 or maybe a whole 100-year-old gray locks, the scent of potato peels, the buzzing of flies banging into the window with rainbow wings, the darkness of corners, replete with little devils, a rabbit in its cage, a stool covered in lamb's wool, crumbs of unknown epics, but the worst of it, that purse contained her eyes, two clear, solid blue marbles. The marbles that jump out of their sockets during car accidents when a person is thrown, especially of their own will, out the window, or when a bomb explodes and they lie there on the asphalt, or hang from tree branches. And it is said that these things follow you with their gaze, wherever you might go, even in your dreams, into other lives, cursing you. So it was an urgent matter to get the money out of the purse as quickly as possible. The older one, weighing the wad in his hand, swallowed his spit. "Not for nothing did we do this work, eh? Mad money here." To surrender to the river's pull, to go to a safe place, covered in little shells, overgrown with tansies that bloomed little pills, where the two of them will wait until everything quiets down. So they each agreed. Who will hold the money? Obviously the green one, decided the brown. The green one hemmed and hawed, but couldn't bring himself to object, for he had the better pant pockets. I mean, look how deep they are, like wells, made for carrying money. It's logical. And he, the green, would go first, so as not to draw suspicion, but not so far that the brown, hanging back conspiratorially, would lose him from his sight. No fancy maneuvers, buddy. They managed to walk the minefield to the river without raising suspicion, and there you aren't any more the brown or the green, just anonymous gray. You warm yourself in the sun with your clothes in carefree bundles under your heads and listen to the buzzing of bees, so pleasing to the ear. Only now, with the danger at a distance, did the young one feel the wolf in its chest, pacing ever smaller circles, baring its fangs, preparing to strike. What in the devil have I got myself into? The money, the lock of hair's money, smelling of her, the darkness of her corners, the rabbit, protruding from his pant pocket, under his head, was burning a hole in his skull. How will he live with a hole in his head? If only he could tie a rock to the bundle. It would sink down into the river, and that would be that, kaput. He would tell the older one, it was there and gone. Do with me what you will. Kill me if you have to. Oh, the drama, the drama. Why did I ever take the scab? Thought the older one. He doesn't have any imagination, doesn't have anything, a blockhead, can't even pretend to be like a normal person. Look how his fingers treacherously twitch, his legs quiver. If we get caught, then it'll only be because of this one with no balls. He himself was laying there. We could say, quite serenely. His eyelashes in the sun, when just barely opened like that, looked fat and golden, like golden timbers. The hot sun, fabulous weather, splash, swim, take deep breaths, but no, the voice of a mouse in a trap with lungs like an air bladder. What do we know? Maybe they were her last. Her last? Let her be happy that we didn't do her in entirely, the last. And you've already in your life to someone. Well, no, not yet. Not yet, you say? Well, you ask the question in such a silly way already. It's not logical. Hungry and stung by cold, they rose from the tansies as soon as it was dusk, both of them now gray, and soon enough black. So in the crackle of night, in the discharge of yellow electricity, for some reason wading into the water under the bridge, they counted their shares of the money by the light of matches. Not evenly, understandably, the younger black one was due only a quarter, for his measly contribution, cowardice, and, well, generally for his lack of professionalism. The two of them had done some things before, the brown one always leading, but after this job, when the braid bit the dust, after a couple of days, they found her prostrate, holding the handle of the aluminum kettle, and had to break her yellow, waxen fingers off. They split up for good. They stopped greeting each other, didn't even look the other's way, even though a shared secret, a real secret like this one, usually brings people together. Years passed, during which one must become something. The elder, the brown, became a judge. Illogical? The analytical thinking of a chess master, good memory, quick comprehension, steely nerves, the heedless pursuit of a goal, courage, determination. What kind of judge can you be without these qualities? And the green? What does a man without balls become for whom a wad of money burns a hole in his pants? He becomes a kind of hole, a big, round hole into which he falls himself. A hole is a darkness. Nothing good came of him. It never does from such material. Even better, one day the judge is given the task of judging his childhood friend. So there. At first, going over the case file, he didn't even associate the last name with the acts committed. Buterkinus, Buterkinus. He used to know a Buterkinus from the distant past, one with grasshopper calves. Suddenly, he began to remember, and his face turned sour, as if he had tasted spoiled soup. In the courtroom, they didn't recognize each other. What was there to recognize? The younger one, a suspect in a robbery case, now looked older than the judge, and it would not have been too much of a stretch to consider him his father. His teeth, as the writer said, had already counted off every other. Thin and thinning hair, covered with a reddish Panama hat, the type more suited for going fishing or butterfly hunting than for a court appearance, a hat he often clutched in his hands. His skin dried out, like an ash tree. Those types have usually seen it all. Soon, something else became apparent. Time-washed eyes with the color of chicory, which seemed to have made their peace with everything already. Humble, yet able to suddenly darken and cut. Razor blades. Closing his eyes, the marbles of his pupils tolling under his lashes, nostrils flaring as if he were sensing the direction of the breeze, he took an interest in the necklace on the judge's neck depicting Themis's scale of justice. My, oh my. And the older one, having decided to evaluate the situation nonchalantly, as completely disconnected from himself, blamed himself in vexation for times past. And why for those innocent childish escapades did I choose this guy, this baggy pants? As if there weren't any other rascals to choose. But baggy pants, the judge soon removed his glasses and cleaned them on the edge of his robe, did not feel at all like a baggy pants in the courtroom. By no means. He was more like the beggar invited to share a meal with you who, while eating and drinking, doing you a favor, starts throwing his bones by your feet, or even better, over your shoulder, entertaining the guests, even hitting the host in the nose. You politely offer him silver cutlery, and he pulls out a jackknife right in front of your face. The judge starts to feel annoyed over this showdown. It's as if he were forced to look at himself with binoculars turned backwards, seeing himself from a distant perspective, from the beginning of the road. Yet he has long since been on the middle of the road. He had even begun to feel the worm of unfulfillment gnawing at him, a black-headed worm. Every day something was annoyingly lacking, something indeterminate. The vitamins of life or something. Colors, scents, salt, pepper. When he really looked hard at himself in the mirror, thinking he were gazing at his very own essence, at the heart of his personhood, he only managed to see a man suffering from chronic constipation. Sometimes he would take a drink, not just anything, but Baron Gaston Legrand Bass Armagnac, or Diplomatico Ambassador. And one time he ended up taking it not on one leg, but on all four, rolling with his robe down the stairs of the courthouse like a sheaf of rye. Thankfully, his fall was only seen by the Gediminas Tower and the Vitus on a horse, so he wasn't so worried about it. The reason? Routine. The drab gray of it all, years of wallowing in shit cases. Is that what he strove for with his talent, hard work, determination, and stubbornness? It was no secret that Lithuanian courts were overrun with stolen chickens, sprats, hatchets, shampoo bottles, laundry lines. No, not those taken off of suicides. That would at least be something, but no. Banalities. Lines of underwear, panties, hoses dragged from the neighbor's yard, sometimes with a half-asleep suburban cow attached to one end. So at night, lying next to his lightly snoring wife, already snoring, but what a gazelle she had been, he would throw off the robes of a regional judge and climb into his idealized contours. An extraordinary man. A big man. A bellwether. And dream of larger fish. Well, we all sometimes get into such states, dreaming of something like that. Catfishes, tenches, captain fish, moving their fins, nobly rustling by our ears. But that climbing in, you must agree, is emptier than empty. What kind of captains can there be? Baggy pants, the judge was chewing on the arm of his glasses. He takes them off, feeling anxious. Then, when his thoughts drift off to who knows where, suddenly, he suddenly returns to the moment, puts them back on, in a hurry, crookedly. He, this Buterkinus, it seems, isn't at all a sprat. This wretch is a captain, a thief, a real thief by the grace of God. He doesn't even steal. He makes things disappear. Who would have thought? The method of disappearance is quite rare in legal practice. So rare, in fact, that we could say it's merely theoretical. What it means is theft not by normal means, but by remote means. When one can do things remotely, there's no need to touch anything. Your fingerprints, those little wrinkles and wavelets of skin, are not counterfeitable, not copyable. They are the only ones on this whole earth and universe. And now they flutter through the air and don't ever land on hard surfaces, leaving no traces after the job is done, not the slightest. It's a high level of aerial acrobatics, the highest. Like a fakir with a pipe who, with a winding melody, draws the cobra out of the dark depths of its jar. Likewise, this one draws things from the hiding places of socks, locks, and safes. But by means that only he knows. The money, the bills, come dancing out as if trained, one after another, rustling into his pockets. Deep pockets. One can only imagine down to his knees, because they are, after all, so baggy. Baggy pants thieves don't do it for the money, nor their teeth, whether they have them or not. They couldn't care less about such crap. For them, stealing is for its own sake. A passion. From the very beginning of the case, the investigation was bogged down. Yet a strong wave of excitation rippled through the standing room only courtroom. Despite the tropical heat, 35 degrees Celsius in the shade, the roofs and asphalt just about melting, the rooks flying with beaks agape, a whole crowd had gathered of suffering supporters, curiosity seekers, fools. People are attracted to the paranormal. Not everyone could even fit into that room of circulating drafts. They crowded around the doors. Someone even got his fingers caught in them and was cut to the bone. Then the usual banal racket of the space was cut by a jungle scream. Finally, from these as if powerful underground blows that swayed the crowd, there was a real tsunami, and the judge, his forehead sweating, his bladder suddenly about to burst. Good God, he can't recall when he hit with so much energy, with all his heart. Nay, with all his strength, the hammer. After the unexpected robbery from the home of the president of the Football Association, a person known to the society, a face, an altruist, a patron of culture, this robbery hurts all of us all the more. Living in a house on the street of the restaurant Bayleaf, a gated street locked and watched with the eyeballs of security cameras, there remained absolutely no legitimate signs of criminal action. No marks of a break-in. Absolute cleanliness. 100,000 vanished from the womb of the safe in those unreachable rooms. Money, not just for anything, but slated for the elderly gone blind and the poor charges of orphans swelling from hunger. And not a trace left behind. The crimes, cut from paper, hangs in the air. Well, our crimes often hang, but this time, and who is the suspect? Maybe some legendary, uncatchable bank robber, like John Dillinger with a dashing hat, a tie or bow tie, a charismatic mustache, leaving behind him a pile of blood-curdling bodies? No, for all intents and purposes, a local wretch wearing a pig color Panama, no mustache, charisma that can't even be mentioned, rotting teeth, despite rustling so much money, with a can of Sprats opened on a newspaper, in a mineshaft room smelling of fried onions, kilometers deep below the ground, a proletarian wolfram light bulb buzzing above his head, and a jackknife for slicing bread and giving himself a pedicure. Such are the lumpen thieves of our flatlands. The wretched penury of our Lithuania. How does it happen? The money disappears and Buterkinis wasn't even at the scene of the crime. Justice, not having proof, only suspicions, even if not entirely unfounded suspicions, fluttered about in the air and tried with all its strength to nail him, clearly acting as a lone wolf, mad, of course, to the wall. It pressed him, there to confess, you see. He has nowhere to go. He's cornered. He's... And Buterkinis, listening to all this nonsense, his lips flickered with the blue flame of a gas stove. He gave himself up to studying the blood-bloated face of a childhood friend sitting in front of him, taking part, not in a legal case, but a corrida. The forehead of a chess master, for once powerless, the chubby cheeks of a peach in dissonant contrast to the manly, four-square chin, sweat shining in the nook of his chin, feature by feature pulling together his death mask. How does it all happen? How does life generally happen for a person? Buterkinis wasn't picky, getting by with only the necessities, more or less with just a jackknife, maybe a fork, and he only used the most important words. Now, with the room gone silent, waiting for him to speak, there came a voice of utmost unpleasantness, something strangled. A voice that hides in the dark, and its owner, these days as well, gets his kidney regularly punched, his liver pecked, kicked and kicked in the solar plexus, in the balls. As if that were not enough, needles crammed under his nails, nerves pulled by tweezers, one by one, creatively, with no anesthesia, ever. Such is this world. That's how it's made. For various reasons, not everyone has made out equally well. Not everyone gets anesthesia. But this wretch Buterkinis, standing with the mien of a lion king, and who gave this shit the right to do that, looked out from high over the crowd and said, "Tell you? You think I'm going to stand here and throw pearls to pigs?" The room was rent by murmur, and the judge silently began to rage. This cheat. This wastrel. This pederast. He wants to play innocent? Throw smoke in our eyes? Even his fingers betray him. Fingers tell us everything about a person. Here are his own charges, following the law. No matter how much he drinks, lying on the table calmly, they have no reason to be unnerved. They know what is what, for what, because of what. But a thieves, they twitch and shake without cease, betraying, clutching a hat, having lost their calm, not sleeping at night, afraid to get caught and brought out into the light. But we will bring them out. We will. An hour had gone by. Still. The witnesses gave testimony, but it was as if they conspired to speak into clouds. Someone, having seen a fact, admitted that, for all intents and purposes, that was only the form of a fact, a fog, mist. Nobody gave humanly reasonable testimony. In the end, heat and fatigue have their effect. They smother the most lively interest, the poor elderly and the orphans swelling from starvation, even the victim, due to a serious deterioration of health, without even taking part in the proceedings, collapsed at home, his palace by bay leaf, lying on a Louis XIV sofa, the hand of the patron hanging from the armrest like a rag, 100,000 in the culo and not a whiff of the thief, to whom, by the devil, is God responsible. In the courtroom, the judge's double chin quivered as he pronounced his judgment. There is not enough evidence to categorically and beyond reasonable doubt constitute a criminal act that would allow us to declare the suspect guilty. The case is decided. The blow of a hammer. A sunlit cloud of dust rose into the air. Buterkinis pulled his Panama onto his thinning hair. When the whole sweaty current spilled out into the corridor, the two of them couldn't avoid a face-to-face meeting, though happily, at a fitting distance. When you think about it, a person, what kind of thing is a person? So thought the judge, out of powerless spite, avoiding those razor eyes. After all, everything is tattooed on this humanoid's face. What else to call him? Deceit, fraud, and whatever else we don't yet know and don't want to know. The humanoid gave him a fatherly smile like it was nothing. Drama. All this drama. My son. Why overvalue the evidence? The facts. The evidence is just a trap, and facts are captivity. And why overvalue yourself? We both know that nothings we are before eternity, both you and I. What fools we are. He even had the insolence to make a joke. On your way home, Your Honor, you might want to check to see if your dough is where you left it. Mwahahahaha. He pushed open the metal law court doors with his bony shoulders and departed into summer. Always the starveling, puny thing, thought the judge, biting his lip, enviously watching him exit into the air, yellow like melted butter. Closed up in his office, freed of his robe, having thrown it off like a limp sail, he exchanged his shoes for slippers. However, knowing all too well that he wouldn't relax like that, he pulled out his Diplomatico Añejo from the cabinet. Upon taking a gulp, he pressed his upper lip hard, the straightened road to the brain, in the matter of that lost generation writer, Ernest Hemingway, his photo on the wall at home depicting him in a rough, hunting sweater, frosty beard, the bullet still waiting for him, the one that will splatter his brains when he is 62, recovering his dignity, his equilibrium, not thinking about his own, as yet uncast bullet, the judge gazed through the window at the steaming roofs that tumbled through the distance. Suddenly, a hum, as if a hummingbird were flapping its little wings right beside his ear. They could whip cream with a wing speed of 80 beats per second. Closing his eyes, he put his hand into his pocket and touched a rugged lizard skin purse, knowing what he will find there, or more exactly, what he will not find. With malevolent joy, he began to pull at it, like a falcon attacking his spoils, but the dough was in its place. Imposter, deceiver, genius, I'm sorry. We mystify the most ordinary aspects of everyday life, driven by the mirage of our errors. We see what is not and cannot be. Nevertheless, he has been robbed. He feels it in his bones, not only from his secret larder, right from under his nose. Every day, every moment. The vitamins of life. Colors, scents, salt, and pepper. By some goddamned remote means, and you won't catch anyone by the hand here. Only bees collect honey like that. So silently and blamelessly. Those little, accurate dissemblers. Swindlers.
That was the short story, By Remote Means, by Lithuanian author Danutė Kalinauskaitė, translated by Rimas Uzgiris, read by Kristen Miller. Enjoy this story and much more literature from Lithuania in Trafika Europe 15, Lithuanian Honey Cake, free online.
You've been listening to The Middle Ground, a series focusing on Central and Eastern European literary cultures. This series is produced by Trafika Europe Radio. Check out our audio and other literary content at traficaeurope.org.
I'm Clayton McKee, and on behalf of everyone at Trafika Europe Radio, thanks for listening.